Let us begin. Just a short prayer. Gracious Father, open our ears to hear your word. Open our hearts to receive it. And fulfill your will in our lives with all of our members. And to you be the praise, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Amen. Welcome. Second time on the Passion Narratives. We're going to do Matthew and Mark today, and contrary to the outline, I'm going to start with Mark. Now, just a very quick little comment about authors. Many years ago, I reckon it would be about 30 years ago, I was preaching here at Beth. Some of you will probably know when, so many years ago, I was assistant preacher here. In the long time ago, when Harry Wendt was here, he used to ask me to preach once a month. Many years ago, I remember I opened a sermon by saying, now we can't be sure who wrote any of our Gospels, and boy did I get into trouble with the vice president of the church. No, not from Harry. No, Harry knew that I was speaking the truth, that it's true. We don't know who wrote any of the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke and John. How do we get those? That's the tradition of the church. And you know, we hold to the scriptures, not the tradition. Our gospels are anonymous, in other words. We don't know who wrote, we don't know for sure who wrote any of the gospels. Having said that, I think it's probably a pretty good tradition. And I've got no better suggestion than Matthew, Mark, and John. So if we talk about the authors of the gospel, just be aware that we're talking about church tradition. The early copies of the Gospels don't have on the top, you know, who wrote the Gospel. This is we have Evangelion kataton Matthaion or something. The Gospel according to. Right? That's important. It's not the Gospel of Matthew. Whose Gospel is it? It's the Gospel of Christ, yeah. So it's important to emphasise that what we have are Gospels who are written by faithful evangelists. We can't be absolutely sure who wrote them. Does it really matter? No. It's going to... I'll just add it to my bucket list. And when I get to heaven, I've got a lot of questions, and that's going to be one of them. And St. Peter, please, will you give me the information? Who wrote these Gospels? All right. Let's start with Mark. I think I said last Sunday that Mark's gospel depicts the passion with unrelieved suffering. When you look at John's gospel, you remember it's the coronation scene, coronation of the king. It's glory, it's divinity, it's gold, it's blue, it's a story of the king on his throne, the faithful son dispensing his will, mother, your son, here's your new mother. There's no emphasis on agony. Everyone knows that crucifixion is a horrible death, but that's not what John is on about. Do you remember? I think we'd said that the Passion of the Christ, with its horrible emphasis on flagellation and whipping and torture and so on, actually misses the point. Many, many people in those days died a more horrible death. A death by crucifixion could take 3 days. Up to 3 days. 9, have you heard? Oh, I never... Okay. Yep. It's slow suffocation, bleeding to death, shock, and so on. Jesus dies relatively quickly. So the emphasis in the gospel is not on Jesus' physical suffering, but surely he has borne our griefs and carried... he was carrying a heavy load. My sin, your sin. So, to get to the outline, you all have a copy, second page, Mark. I call it grey on grey, or black on grey, or grey on black, whichever you are. Black on black is a bit hard to see anything, isn't it? But it's unrelieved passion. Grey on grey. Okay. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, I'm colorblind, so. No, I know grey. I know white, black, and grey. I know some colors, but I don't pretend to know all these fancy colors that other people think they can see. Mark's story is not one of unrelieved despair or hopeless sadness. No, not at all. Mark also reflects the church's faith that Golgotha means victory. But it's not spelled out the same way as in other Gospels. And in 2 weeks' time, when we get to Easter story, we'll see that Mark's Easter story ends in a weird way. Do you remember how the Easter story in Mark finishes? The women leave the tomb frightened. What a funny way to finish. Easter should be, hooray, the Lord is alive. The women leave with questions. They don't know what's going on. They're frightened. We'll talk about later. Why does Mark do that? It's an interesting question. Jesus, yes. The film Risen? No, I haven't.
Yeah, I've talked about the film Risen. Some of you may have seen it out at the Piccadilly. It takes it from the crucifixion, and it takes it from one of the henchmen of Pontius Pilate. I've forgotten his name now, it doesn't matter. But he was told to find out what's going on here, because he knew that, you know, if the body had disappeared, he'd be in trouble with his Roman authorities. And he then becomes a believer through the evidence that sort of the tomb and that sort of thing. But yet, as you said, there's no joy really there that portrayed in that, which is quite interesting.
Yes, it got a very good write-up in the last Lutheran. How many of you get the Lutheran? Good. It's a good write-up by, what's his name, Hadley. He gives it a very, and he's very fussy about movies. It's good. I intend to see it. You think it's worthwhile to? Good, okay. Yeah. I'm not a great fan of biblical films. I'm thinking like King of Kings and Ben-Hur and so on. They're monstrous, awful stuff. Terrible. Anyway. Jesus is totally deserted. He's alone in his trial. No women weeping over Jesus. No compassion at all. Why might that be? What is Mark saying? See, the Gospels, they choose them, the writers. They choose what to put in, they choose what to leave out. What might that Mark be saying with Jesus deserted?
Just the desertion of God. God has
deserted him.
And that undermines
why
Jesus
is
there.
Yeah.
We can't miss
the fact he's there. Yes, he's alone. No one else is there carrying his load. He's the only one who can carry our load. I think that's what Mark is doing, emphasising that it's Christ alone for us.
I did write in the News for the Pews many years ago about the aloneness of Christ at his passion, and actually that won me a husband.
That's good. Well done, Bernice. By writing about the loneliness of Christ, she became unlonely. I think that's lovely. Fantastic. Well done. Okay. Jesus is alone in his trial. No one speaks up for him, of course. He's denied by Peter. He's deserted by all the disciples. They all flee from him. And he doesn't even have the strength to bear his own patibulum. The Latin for the crossbeam. He can't even carry that. That's how beaten, defeated he is. There's no one to express pity for him along the way, as in Luke's Gospel. Luke shows Christ being the recipient of compassion. He's offered a numbing drink, a spiced wine to numb the pain, but he refuses it. He doesn't drink. John's Gospel, Jesus drinks. Mark, he doesn't. Now, which is true? Well, I would say Jesus drank something in what happened. It's that Mark leaves it out. He wants to see Jesus alone, no relief, unrelieved suffering, passion. Verse 23 suggests that they continued to try to give him the drink, and I suppose we can suggest Jesus did eventually drink. By the way, the wine in those days was pretty much like our vinegar anyway. So there's two versions, wine mixed with vinegar, vinegar, wine, it doesn't really matter. It wasn't good Barossa Shiraz, I know that. So Jesus remains fully conscious. If you drink the wine, maybe that's relieving the pain, but there is no relief for Jesus, no relief at all. He remains conscious during the following torment. The soldiers, in dividing his clothing, take away his last possession and dignity. People in those days were crucified naked. You think of the shame and the indignity of that, being exposed on a cross for all to come by and laugh at you. Shame in that society is just as, perhaps even more acute. In Jewish society, of course, nakedness is not just a matter of personal shame, but it's an abomination to the Lord, as the Old Testament says. Nowadays, our modern fashion leaves very little room for shame, can I put it the way, I mean, you look at the way some people dress at the Academy Awards, they're not skirts, they're just wide belts. Three groups mock Jesus. Those passing by, just anyone, the mob, you could say. And then the Jewish religious leaders. You know, the church council arrives to mock the Son of God. And finally, the other two men on either side of Jesus on their crosses. Both of them mock. Not the same as in Luke, remember? It's the repentant one. The taunt in verse 29 and 30 confirms Jesus' apparent impotence. If you are the Son of God, come down from the cross. Now, it's handy to know a bit of Greek sometimes. In the Greek, that is an unreal conditional, which means, since you are the Son of God, come down. If you go out in the rain, you'll get wet. It's not a real if, is it? If you go out, if you stand in front of a speeding car, you'll get hit, perhaps killed. That's not a real if. When you stand out in front of a speeding car, you get, okay, it follows. So the taunt is, okay, you are the Son of God. Show it. Come on. Get down from the cross. And that is a horrible, horrible if. It reminds us of another if. Earlier in Jesus' ministry, someone comes to Jesus and says, in the temptation, the echo. It's the echo. Since you are the Son of God, turn these stones into bread. If you are the Son of God. So, the passion story in Mark's Gospel is... No, let me start again. Who wins the battle between Jesus and the devil out in the wilderness, in Mark? Who wins? It's clear in Matthew and Luke. It's quite clear. The devil leaves Jesus defeated. And in Luke's Gospel, when does the devil turn up again? At the end, when he enters into Judas's heart. So that the ministry of Jesus in Luke's Gospel is a kind of the devil has vacated the scene and Jesus has the upper hand, except at the end when the devil is coming along again to taunt Jesus at the end. Mark's Gospel, who wins? No one. We're not told. That's right. It looks like it, but we're simply told the devil left Jesus. So what does that mean? It means that the whole of Jesus' ministry is a battle between Satan and Jesus. It's not over in the wilderness. That's simply the opening. Straight after the baptism of Jesus and the calling of the disciples, when Jesus is declared Son of God by the voice, this is my Son, and so on, what's the first thing Jesus does? An exorcism. And then you have the Jesus healing Peter's mother-in-law. A man does not touch a woman in bed. Why not? Might be that time of the month. That would make him unclean. Demonic uncleanness, demons uncleanness, and so on. Even in rabbinic theology, you have to be very careful when you go to the toilet, because the toilet is a place where demons hang out. So there's some wonderful stories in the rabbinic literature where the rabbis had a little hole cut in the side of the toilet. And there's one rabbi who's used to insist that his... This is true, Louise. You're laughing, but this is true. The rabbi would go to the toilet and his daughter would stick her hand through the hole and touch her father while he was inside doing his business. I'm just saying that to show how seriously they took uncleanness and the demonic. Okay? Oh, back to here. Sorry about that. Forget it. The superscription, Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews, is mentioned as also the brigands. I'm on the wrong parallel. If you are the Son of God, come down. So can he even do so if he wants to? Well, we know, but Mark doesn't even hint of the possibility of Jesus coming down. After 3 hours of darkness, 3 p.m., Jesus at last says something. And what is it? Psalm 22 verse 1. My God, why have you deserted me? Why have you forsaken me? And there's no point in trying to say, well, God didn't really desert Jesus. This is what he felt at the... No, at this moment, Jesus is alone. He's alone. His Heavenly Father is not on his side. Because Jesus is unclean at this moment. He's bearing our uncleanness. The Christian reader may know that this cry is also one of faith in God. My God, my God. The great people of God have very often felt abandoned by God. It's only people of great faith who can cry out to God and say, God, why have you left me? E.g. Abraham. E.g. Moses. E.g. And we can go on. You look at the Bible. The people who cry out are people of David. David wrote Psalm 22. My God, why have you forsaken me? It's only when we've got great faith that we can complain to God. And if people say, God, why do you allow... Well, at least that's a sign of some faith, isn't it? And in our counselling of people in grief, and we can say, look, your very crying out to God is a sign of the fact that there's something there. There's some faith. God's not going to let you go. So, cry of dereliction. The Christian reader knows that this cry is also one of faith in God who can rescue Jesus. But there's no rescue. As yet, no rescue. The cry only adds fuel for the mockery of those who stand by. Now, listen to him crying. He's lost Julia.
Why doesn't Mark, I know some of the other Gospels do, that triumphant cry of Jesus, it is finished. That really shows the victory of Jesus over Satan. Why is that not included in Mark?
Excellent, excellent question. My first answer, wait till you get to heaven and ask him. In other words, I don't know. It's your bucket list, yeah. But I think I know the answer. It's defeat, not victory in Mark. In John, it's victory. In Luke, it's victory. In Mark, suffering. So when does the victory come? It's only Easter. It's only Easter that there's any sign. And even then, Mark has a weird way of expressing it. Sorry?
Mark follows.
Yes, exactly, Pauline. Yeah. Mark shows the Passion story as a fulfillment of Psalm 22. Quite right. Okay, there is the tearing of the temple veil. But the most, by the way, the tearing of the temple veil, I think I said last time, we know that was what was on the temple veil was appliqué. There was no imagery in the temple allowed, no sculpture, no painting, but on the veil, according to the Jewish historian Josephus, writing at the end or first century or beginning of the second, were the sun, stars and moon, which represented heaven. So behind the veil is heaven, the Holy of Holies, and that is ripped open when Jesus dies, which means now there is access, exactly, there's access to the heavenly realms. There's no longer any need for the annual sacrifice of the high priest finding his way through the veils and spilling blood on the holy place. Now the blood here has been spilt. The most important word is that spoken by the centurion under the cross. Truly, this man was God's son. Or you can translate it, this man was a son of God. There is no word a in Greek. We have the definite article, a indefinite article. Greek has only the definite article. And if the definite article is missing, you can translate it as a. This was a son of God. A Roman centurion would probably not say this was the Son of God. He'd have to be well educated in Jewish faith and so on, but he could say a Son of God, definitely. But for the Christian reader, we know what he's saying. We know the deep truth in what the centurion was saying. This is God's Son. And that echoes, of course, if you are the Son of God, doubt, dare, challenge, and, right at the beginning of the Gospel, this is my Son, the Beloved One, okay, at Jesus' baptism. So there's this theme, the Son of God, running right through. Matthew and Luke also picture women standing at a distance and looking at all of these events. This role has special significance for Mark. You imagine being a mother and watching your son hanging up there naked and suffering. It's terrible. Shocking. Luke's scene is busy with people almost crowding around the cross. In Mark, no one approaches the cross. He's alone. The people stand afar off. And so the mystery that marks his early ministry remains. He's alone, he's deserted, without comfort, without help. There are no signs of victory, as in Matthew. And yet, what's Mark getting at? The whole of the gospel is written out of faith, for faith. So we are to interpret, we are to understand. The centurion has the last say. No, wrong. God has the last say. There's Easter. But the mystery is even unresolved by Mark's resurrection account. Though we know Jesus is risen, the women go home in fear. Who is this Jesus? So Mark challenges us to see through, and this is one of his favourite terms, the mystery. The mystery. The word mystery is a wonderful word. The word muein in Greek means to go around with your eyes closed. A mysterion is something you see with your eyes closed. In other words, it's not seen with normal sight. The mystery is something that is not perceived empirically. You know what I mean by empirically? That is with the five senses, or rationally. In the Greek Orthodox Church, in the Orthodox, Russian, Greek, whatever, they don't use the word sacrament. They don't use the word sacramentum, which is in the Latin Western Church, and sacrament comes from the Latin, which means military oath. A sacramentum is an oath. It is a something to be taken very solemnly. In the Greek Orthodox Church, they don't talk about Lord's Supper or sacrament. They talk about the mystery. And I love that. I really like that. Sometimes I wish we Lutherans would talk about it. On Sunday we will celebrate the mystery, the mysterion. When my eyes and ears and everything is involved, I can see that piece of bread, I can sip that wine, and yet what I'm getting through that is mystery. It's a wonderful. Any of you have an Orthodox background? Have I done justice to the Orthodox tradition? I love that, that sense of mystery. And one of my, which Russian, which one, Tina? Lyle.
I'm going to ask you a question about verse 32. Verse 32 says, "Let the Christ, the King of Israel, come down now from the cross, that we may see and believe." A couple of points. What would they have believed if he had come down? And how come they couldn't believe after all that I had seen already?
Good question. Again, put it to your bucket list when you get there. It's a good, very good question. What would they have believed? Remember, Paul says, the Greeks seek wisdom, Jews seek signs. God accompanied Israel through the wilderness through signs, and so the pious church and the Jewish leaders could say, well, God always gave us signs, so now we should have another sign. But this is the moment not for signs, but for the sign. There's only one sign. The sign of the cross. The sign of God's self-giving, unconditional, gracious self-giving in the deserted, suffering Christ. When people ask, why does God allow suffering in this world? Why does God? I have no answer except, and all good theological answers are Christological. That's Lutheran, by the way. That's typically Lutheran. If you want an answer to the any theological question, even creation, Christ is the answer. Okay, if you want an answer, my answer would be, I don't know why God allows suffering in this world, but that's not the biggest mystery. The biggest mystery is that God himself is a suffering God. God has suffered. God in Christ is my suffering, Lord. Okay. Matthew, we have 12 minutes left. Sorry, Matthew. What do we know about? We know a little bit about Matthew, whoever the author was, but Matthew's good enough for me. We know at least what his aim was. You remember the family tree in Luke? Luke chapter 2 finishes. It starts with Jesus' parents, the Joseph line, and it finishes with, any of you remember? Where does it trace Jesus' origin, Luke? Back to Adam, the son of God. Adam, the son of God. Interesting. And then comes the temptation. If you are the son of God, here's the new Adam. In Luke's gospel, Jesus is son of God, Messiah, son of man, all of that, but he's also the new Adam. Where Adam gave into temptation, Jesus doesn't. It's very important to see those little things. In Matthew, where's the family tree go back to? Abraham, that's right. Quite right. Huh? Not Adam, but Abraham. Now what's going on here? Luke's gospel is interested in the universality of the Christian faith. Adam represents the whole of humankind. Jesus dies for everyone. Matthew? Well, Matthew would have the same too. You've got the story of the wise men who come from far, the other nations. But Matthew's main concern is to show how Jesus fulfills the hopes of Israel. Jesus fulfills the hopes of Israel. So the church is Israel. Yeah, the church is Israel. Or if you want to put it more bluntly, who's dying on the cross? Israel is. Jesus is Israel. Where can I at any moment of history say, there is true, believing, faithful Israel, the suffering servant. The Old Testament, that's also Jacob or Israel. Israel is my son, my beloved. It's Hosea. Where can you see Israel in its essential, purest form? In the person of one person, in one man. Israel dies. Okay. Matthew very closely follows Mark's account. The usual theory is that Mark comes first. You know, the order of our Gospels is not a statement about the chronology of which was written first. There was a belief in the early church that Matthew came first. I think that belief is probably conditioned by the fact that Matthew is written for, obviously, Jewish Christians, a strong Jewish background. And so as the church, as it grew from Jewish Christianity to Greek, Roman, Hellenistic world. So that's possibly why Matthew came first. Nowadays, for various reasons that I'm not going to bother you with, it has to do with textual analysis, tradition analysis, people usually say Mark came first. I couldn't care. It doesn't bother me which came first. That's not on my bucket list. Matthew closely follows Mark's account, that is, if Mark was written first. He changes Mark's spiced wine into wine mixed with gall. Why? Probably to make the reference to Psalm 69:22 more explicit, where it speaks about wine mixed with gall. It's probably conditioned by the Old Testament, but I don't know. That's a guess. Now, in Mark we have the Aramaic. Eloi, Eloi, sabachthani. My God, why have you forsaken me? Matthew turns it into Hebrew. Eli, Eli, El is God in Hebrew, or El or Elohim. Emmanuel, hear the word? Iman is with us, El, God. Emmanuel. So Matthew has the Hebrew, and it comes out as Eli. E is the suffix for the first person, my God. El God, Eli, my God. Elohim, your God. This allows the crowds to make the misunderstanding. He's crying out for Elijah. It wouldn't make sense if you had the Aramaic. Now again, exactly what happened, what the crowd, whether Jesus cried in Hebrew or in Aramaic, it does not matter. This is not reporting for the advertiser. This is not reporting for a court. This is not modern history writing. This is sermonic writing to get to a point of faith. The main difference in Matthew, however, is in the signs in 51 and 54. You remember the temple veil is torn. We have that again. There's new access to the Holy God. There's unimpeded access now. You can simply come straight to God. We have only one mediator between human beings and God. One letter in the New Testament spells that out in great detail. You probably remember the letter to the Hebrews. That's what it's about. Unimpeded access. There are other signs. There's earthquake. Now, interesting. There's a stilling of the storm in Matthew, isn't there, as in the other gospel writers. Where the other gospel writers, Matthew and Mark, they speak about, you remember the stilling of the storm on the Lake of Galilee? They say there was a lilaps, which means strong wind, lilaps. Matthew doesn't have lilaps. He has seismos. Does that ring a bell? Seismos. Seismograph, yeah, seismos is the Greek word for earthquake. So seismograph is measuring earthquake. Now that's interesting. Matthew has Jesus stilling an earthquake. And when Jesus dies, there's an earthquake. It's only Matthew. Those little things, I think, are hints at what's Matthew getting at. In Jewish apocalyptic literature, that is literature that speaks about the end time, one of the main signs that the end is at hand is the earthquake. The earth shakes on its foundations. There's something new happening. The old has to be removed in order for the new. You remember Paul says, the old has disappeared, the new has come. If we have eyes of faith, we see the new, again, through Christ, through the Christ glasses, if you like. When we put on the glasses of Christ, we see the whole world in a different light. We see each other in a different light. So what's Matthew saying with this earthquake stuff? The end times have arrived. This end time when God was going to shake the foundations and something totally new is here. It has happened with Christ. There's the splitting of the rocks, the opening of graves, the appearance of Old Testament saints in Jerusalem. But only, of course, after the resurrection. The end times are here. So all this interprets Jesus' death as the beginning of the end. Marked by victory over death. Yeah. The signs of victory. Not as in Mark. Matthew has quite clear victory. So how can we sum up? Perhaps this is one way of summing up. Matthew is interested in Jesus as the messianic king who fulfills Israel's hopes. There remains the paradox. The king has arrived. He's here. But he's seen in the weakness of suffering on a shameful cross. That's the paradox. You know what a paradox is. Something against what you would expect. Doxa is opinion or expectation. Paradox against your expectation. I'll ask you again. Which of these four do you really like? Matthew, Mark, Luke? Now, of course, silly question, but we naturally have human preferences. Is it the coronation of the king? Is it the suffering Jesus who calls for compassion as we see him suffering and calls us to repentance? That's Luke. Is it the unrelieved suffering of Mark, which also reminds me of the mystery of God for me in God's own loneliness? Or is it in Matthew where I am reminded that I am now part of Israel. I am part of God's chosen people and the great plan of God that runs right from Abraham through history. It comes to me in my baptism and in the assurance of God at the end. I'm part of that end. I'm not forgotten. Which one do you like? Who likes John? Colin? Okay. Who likes Luke?
I like that too.
You like Luke too? Okay.
Yeah, I love Luke, the father
Luke. Yeah.
And then I'm drawn to John.
Yeah.
The John.
Yes. Mark? It's interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. That's interesting. The number of you say, yeah, that's good. Yeah. No, of course. This is a silly question. Which one do you like?
If I just saw one and didn't ever read the others, I would miss out.
It's worth saying.
I would really miss out on a huge amount. And that's just like when we read the scriptures. If we just read one book all the time, we're going to miss out on all the other treasures. It's like a diamond with all the different facets. And that's how God is. We never can understand him either because all the facets.
I think also it depends on what life has dished out for us and where are we in our own personal suffering with our family, with our friends. Surely the suffering of Christ in Matthew resonates more with me because of my own personal suffering. That's.
You realise that was a profound theological statement. Just theology. No, I mean it. I'm not flattering. Theology is always applied theology. It's not theory. We are not here talking about some heavenly vision, but how God speaks to us personally. And that's an excellent way of expressing it. Lyle, you were going to say something.
I just want to ask you a question about something we say most Sundays in church about what Jesus did, that he descended into hell. Now, we don't really make a lot of this. I've never really heard that talked about very much. Just wondering whether you've got anything that you could add to what's actually meant by that.
Very, very quickly, it means he really died. He went into Hades. Yeah. In the book of Hebrews, we have... he went and preached to the prisons, the souls in prison. But that's a part of Christ's ascension. He's moving up through the realms of the imprisoned demonic forces, and he says, ha ha, I beat you, on his way to his heavenly throne. That's the picture in Hebrews. It's not a descent. If you want to have a perfect answer, look up the Lutheran Confessions, formula of Concord, on the descent into hell. And they do not dogmatize on it. They don't dogmatize. Basically, I see it as a statement of both Christ's victory, of his real death. Jesus did not fake it. He did not fake it. He descended into Hades. Hades is the Greek word for the place of the dead. He's really dead. He was not resuscitated after swooning on the cross. Does that come out in Risen, Julia? There's no faking it. He was really dead. They buried him. That comes out in the film. Okay, good. Is that the one where Joseph Fiennes is acting in it?
Yes, the one that played
Luther. Fiennes is the actor of the centurion. Okay, very good. Who else? Louise?
Last one.
I was just going to say that one of the things that is attractive about Mark is that from the point of view of the disciples, they're very imperfect, and that's quite liberating. And that they actually do end the gospel afraid is... but the fact that this gospel still came to us through time was still the testament of their ultimate faith, that this somehow came to us and was handed down to us. So the gospel has the final word, even though its last statement is afraid.
Thank you, Louise. Yes, in Mark's Gospel, the disciples come across as real dumb bunnies, real dimwits, don't they? They don't understand. And that's, again, this pastoral. Mark is writing to people who are struggling with the faith, and he's saying, so you think it was easy for the old boys who were there when it happened? No. It wasn't easy for them too. Okay. God bless you in the coming week. We are 2 minutes over. I'm sorry. The police are about to arrest me.